Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, owner and lead writer. Ken, my co-host, couldn't join us this week, but we have a special guest nonetheless from Cryptic Comic, owner and lead designer, Vic Davis.
Hey, Josh, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. I'm a big fan of your games. I think I own all of them by now.
Well, thanks.
Now,
every bit helps.
Now, this week, for those of you listening, I did a spotlight for Vic's latest game, Occult Chronicles. And so, Vic, for the people who aren't too familiar, could you tell us a little bit about Cryptic Comic and the type of games you like to make?
Yeah, sure. I actually started off making educational CD-ROMs in the late 90s. In 1998, with my brother, we started a company. And we made, Civil War tours. And our little shtick was that we created CD-ROMs for big battles like Gettysburg and Antietam, where you could actually see all the troop movements. And that's where I actually cut my chops and learned, Adobe Director, which is what I've been making, to a lot of people's woe with these games in over all these years. So we started off doing that, and then I decided to leave, and California had gotten a little too expensive, so we ended up moving. We'd all moved out there, and just doing contractual work for my brother. And then I had the idea, well, you know what, I'll try to make a game, because I'd always loved turn-based strategy games, and the classics like Master of Orion 2. I wasn't a big Master of Orion player. Came in a little late on that one, but Master of Orion and Civilization, of course, and all, and games like that. So I thought, well, I'll try my hand at it. And some of it just seemed too daunting, like how I would ever program an artificial intelligence or something like that. But I had a background in college, in the 80s, so it's digging deep, but as an electrical engineer and taking some programming courses. And I'd been doing the computer CD-ROM course, development, which is different, but I tried to put it all together, and that's, after 3 years of slugging away on it, that's how Armageddon Empires came about.
Yep. So your actual company started in 2004, right?
Correct. I got myself a little website, and I did a I think it was called yourbusiness.com or mybusiness.com, and incorporated didn't have any income or profits for 3 years. It took that long to make the game, yeah. But it was fun. It was doing that. You would wake up and you could not imagine that you were ever going to finish the project. And yeah. It's just really tough.
So the company has been around for just about 9 years by now, and I think it's interesting just how much the market has changed over the course of that time. How, like, from your point of view, how has, like, developing games as an independent developer grown and changed over the decade?
Oh, it's changed completely. When I started in 2004, the 2007, at first I wasn't even thinking how I was going to sell it. I knew it was going to be online, and the experiences I'd had selling CD-ROMs, the big boogeyman is the middleman, the retailer. They take, a heinous chunk of your sales out. I mean, sometimes it's 55-60% for them. And they own the customer, and you're selling through them, and it's really depressing selling through a middleman, a retailer. And things have started changing to this whole, the digital distribution was really, something that as a developer, I was really looking forward to test out and get in on, because it just really starting to bloom. And the idea of selling direct to customers and all you were paying for was the count the transaction and whatever bandwidth, you went with a company like I use, BMT Micro, which basically handles everything for about a 9.5% cut. And nowadays there's even, you can even, a lot of people homebrew their own and do credit card processing, and there's a Humble Store and things like that are really good deals. So it's changed a lot in that way, but, at the time there was a forum I would go to all the time. I don't even know if it's still around. It was called Dexterity. Yeah, I don't know if you ever remember that. It was a guy. He ended up becoming a motivational speaker, but while he was doing this, he was sort of a little pop icon for small indie developers. And from the life of me, I cannot remember his name. But the forums were Dexterity, And all, a lot of people would hang out there and you, it was a shareware scene at first, I believe. But the whole idea of selling direct and finding customers and selling directly to them with your, you know, your niche product and the long tail, it was really exciting. So it's gone from that, you know, to now you've seen a huge, you know, you've seen some really big gorillas come into the market, like Steam and Good Old Games to a lesser extent. And Paradox, of course, has its service, you know, Stardock has its, I guess it's sold its majority to GameStop. But, you know, but basically what you saw then was this transformation, and it's tougher and tougher now, to sell directly to a customer. You're seeing the middleman pop back up. And that's good, for a lot of customers because they love having everything consolidated with their collection, and the customer support is going to be better. I try to do a really good job of customer support. If somebody, you know, I don't have a lot of customers, but if somebody emails me and wants they can't get their download again and they need to reauthorize, I try to get that out as quickly as possible. But anyway, so I'm just saying, you know, it's changed a lot since 2004 and 2007 when I got the game out. And from that point on, you've also seen, you know, the mobile scene has impacted people who sell on PCs like me. Because of the price deflation. You know, you sort of saw this in the casual market at first, and now it's full blown, spread everywhere. You know, the 99-cent game and the price ceiling on those mobile games, it even affects PC makers, like PC game makers like myself. So it's a tough market.
Yeah, and it's definitely changed, as you were saying, regarding Steam and GOG. There was a time where a lot of people didn't think this was actually going to work. I remember when I first saw Steam with Half-Life 2, I think that was like 03 or 04, I was like, this never worked. Why do I want, you know, give up my copy of the game to this weird platform? And now, you know, 10 years later, I buy pretty much 90% of my games on Steam. And it has really, in a sense, become like, you know, like a golden ticket, for better or for worse, for independent developers.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I talked to a lot of developers, and I think the thing that people lose the most sleep over at night is, am I going to get on Steam? And if I've been on Steam, are they still going to keep approving my games? Steam is very opaque and Byzantine. The process by which they decide what comes on, gets on their service and what doesn't, I haven't been able to figure it out. And I've got a rather strange history myself with Steam, sort of it's like the ant, you know, trying to bite the elephant, but, but, you know, that's a whole other story. But I'd like to be on Steam, so if there's, you know, this Gabe, you're listening, or anybody else out there's listening, give me a call.
If Gabe is listening to this, I'll be really happy. I just now seen, just did their whole big early access program. I think it was last year that actually got started. And that's been having mixed results from a lot of people. Like, we've seen, like, some developers have been having trouble getting on, and something like the War Z and a lot of like, lower quality games just smashing, you know, skirt right by.
Yeah, and then they're charging. I mean, some of the complaints I've seen is you can pay $70 or $80 for an alpha, basically.
They have control of the pricing, but, like, some companies, I think the one you're talking about is Planetary Annihilation. I just got into a whole bunch of trouble last regarding.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And, like, the other side, we have like, something like Kerbal Space Program. They're charging, they actually had their early access on sale, which is interesting because the game's like version 0.20.21. It's been alpha for over a year now. So, it's definitely a bit mixed. Another developer I know that's also had trouble getting on to Steam was, Soldak Entertainment. They did Drox Operative, Dense Curse, and I think Path of Exile,
Kiwi's Underworld,
yeah,
and the Depths of Peril. Yeah, actually, I've never talked to Steven Peeler. I'm a big fan of his games. I'm playing Drox Operative right now and really like it. And it's interesting because I've seen on message boards the difficulty he's had getting his games on. I think, you know, eventually he does seem to, you know, find the magic handshake. Talking to a lot of developers, like I said, Steam's very, very opaque and Byzantine, and figuring out the process to get on is difficult, to say the least.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, I like Trollocs Operative 2. It's another one that's really, it hits like just like all the right points for me, much like how I like about your games as well. That they have like that very unique design in terms of how the mechanics connect, that it does deliver a very satisfying experience.
Oh yeah, he does a great job of modeling sort of a living environment around the player. You know, Depths of Peril especially, but the Drox Operative, you know, the flow of the game around the player, you really feel like you're in a changing universe, and you're not going to, you're the Drox Operative, you're going to be the hero, but you're not always going to be, you know, the planet, annihilator. Well, I guess you can even do that too. I don't, but you know, I'm saying you get the feeling that you're one part of this larger system that's moving all in different ways.
Yeah, and I think he's announced a actual expansion pack. I think last month. I don't know when it's coming out, but so of course add more stuff to it.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's something to look forward to.
Alright, so let's move on, and I want to first talk about Armageddon Empires, because this was of course your first game. Yeah, I think it's, right now, I think it's the most recognizable from your studio because it was such an interesting combination of turn-based strategy and collectible card games.
Yeah.
I guess first off, with a game like this, I guess where did the original concept come from to merge CCG and turn-based into one game?
It just came from my, you know, I started off, I moved away from California, my wife got a job teaching at a university in Ohio, and I sat down and I said, okay, I'm going to start this game company and, I need a project. And my first idea was, to do, you know, a Darklands type, game where you'd move around on a board in sort of a medieval Europe crusade era Europe, and you'd have different encounters. And, you know, it's sort of what, Occult Chronicles turned into, but with just the focus of the house, the haunted house. So I finally ended up managing to get there, but it took a long time, but, it didn't work at first. And so creating all the plumbing and framework and programming to do the, inventory and all the different aspects, it was just too tough. So, I ended up changing direction and then trying to create a strategy game. And at first I thought it would be a very simple strategy game. It'd be, you know, a hex-based game where you'd move some things, some pieces on the board, and it just snowballed. I started getting, I don't know if the muse was singing or what, but I started getting crazy ideas about adding the cards to be your resource base, so how you would move the units into the game, and it took off.
I don't know if we mentioned this at the beginning of the cast, but not only are you the designer, you also do the programming for your games, correct?
Yes, in my own way, I do the programming. I work in Adobe Director. Like I, you know, said before, it's a scripting-based language. It has similarities to JavaScript, you know, script a little bit. In fact, you can use JavaScript in Adobe. But I use what's called Lingo, which is the native language for Director. And it's a neat scripting language. It's actually, you know, people, I'm sure I know, look down on my programming efforts here, but I'm quite proud of, you know, some of the things that I managed to pull off. You know, especially with the AI. The AI gets mixed reviews. I think that's, you know, you can listen to people like Soren Johnson talk about their struggles with AI, and they're working with multi-million dollar companies and, you know, people who are a lot smarter than me, PhDs and advanced degrees in computer science. And it's tough. And I think, you know, what I managed to do with the scripting language and building, you know, basically a goal-based architecture that'll respond to character, you know, respond to the player's movements on the board as the AI reads it, because the AI isn't all knowledgeable in any of my games. It gets information through a filtered system just like the player would, it doesn't cheat, you know, quote cheat. yeah, I mean, so for anywhere from the pathfinding I did to the goal-based architecture, it's tough. And that was the biggest challenge in Armageddon Empires. It was the biggest challenge in my second game, Solium Infernum. And even in both those games, there's been a mixed response. I think, you know, you could talk about AI forever. I think some of the issues are psychological for players. You know, players, it's a whole Turing machine, you know, type situation where, they realize they're facing a machine, and I think there's that wall is there all the time for believability of whatever the machine's doing. If it makes a great move, it's just pure luck. If it makes a bad boneheaded move, it's just dumb AI. So it's a tough business to be in.
Yeah, that's something that has never really like grown to the point that we can say we have, you know, human like AI. That's always been like one of the most challenging ones just about any strategy game. And as you're saying, like, the problem is that when you have really good AI, it's hard to tell if it's good because it knows, you know, what's going on in the game, or it's good because, you know, the designer just gave them 10,000 extra resources and free units and stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, I always had a problem, like, when I did Armageddon Empires, you know, the scouting and figuring out intelligence on the board, where unit dispositions was a big part of the game. And I actually did program the AI so that it moves its units around. It can only see what those units can. And there's a whole roll, you know, a dice roll system on when it does a check, an observation check, it was called. And, you know, I did a goal-based system, so it would have these patterns. It would want to move its scouts around, and if it found something, it would send basically a message to the central AI to create a goal, you know, attack whatever that is. And sometimes it said, oh, look, I have a nuke that I'd found in, you know, in a submarine that derelict, and it would launch at the player's base, and I'd get these emails saying, you know, I'm cheating. So, you know, it's just, as developers, it's tough. I can't say that enough. I mean, you look at, Arkan games, Chris does a great job of solving this problem, I think, by building a system where it's asymmetrical. And the AI doesn't necessarily play by the same game rules that the player does. And I think that's the future of it. I know the next time I pick up a pad to design my next turn-based game, it's going to do something asymmetrical like that, where you're working against a system. You can understand the system and how it gets its energy or its units or whatever it is that it's using against you. But it's going to have a different process to formulate its moves than the player is. It'd be completely fair, and that's what you'll be working against. But to try to build the real the thinking machine, I think is, you know, even the experts nowadays are having, you know, like people like Stardock are having, you know, have difficulties doing it.
Yeah, and the problem with AI is that once you know the limitations, it becomes just very easy to work around them and just figure out the most optimal way to win. I mean, I've seen, you know, strategy guides for games like Civilization and other ones that once you know the extent of what the AI can and cannot process, it just renders the game, you know, pretty much boring for all but, you know, the novice players.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the holy grail. It's, you know, they're trying to figure out some adaptive AI that is ever changing, you know, ever trying to correct its weak spots. But you're right. Right now, you grok the system. You know, that's you figured it out. It almost is sort of a anticlimax, you know, type thing to play.
Speaking about asymmetrical, do you have a chance to check out Arkan's new game, Skyward Collapse?
No, you know, it just came out really recently, I think, you know, in early June, and I've had my head down, so I've read about it, and it sounds like it has a very interesting, you know, premise of trying to balance these two factions. I think it's Greek and Norse, right?
Yeah, Greek and Norse, and they're going to do an expansion with the Japanese, I think, in a month or two.
I mean, the premise sounds wonderful. I've heard some really, you know, praise for, you know, what it's trying to do. And I looked at the, you know, I love just the look of the screenshots. The tiled look like that with the square tiles looks really cool. But I haven't had a chance to dig into it at all.
Yeah, that was definitely something interesting because, as you're saying, it is completely about asymmetrical design, but it's asymmetrical by the fact that the player is the one who's doing it. The AI really only controls the units on the field, but you dictate basically what's happening on said field. And it's just so complete. It's what I said in my analysis, it's balanced by the fact that it's imbalanced. Like, this is a game where you can give, like, one unit, like, 100 times attacks, right, and just have them just walk around one hit killing everything.
The god on the earth. Is that one of the mythological units they're talking about?
Yeah, there's mythological units, and then there's, like, mythological items, like,
Thor's hammer or something like that. Yeah.
That you like place down and they either give a benefit to you and picks it up or a god will walk over and then use it and then all kinds of insanities after that.
Well, you need them attacking each other, but you have to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand and one of them is exterminated.
Going back to Armageddon Empires, one other question I have about the AI, as you said that you design around like a goal-based system, did the AI actually like have their own deck cards or did?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, actually that, and I did it in a very probably primitive way. It should have been procedural. And if I could go back and change it, I probably would. But I ended up spending like a month and a half building AI decks. So I would, using my deck editor, I would build a deck, and then I had a bunch of, AI parameters that would be attached to that deck when I saved it. I saved it as a special AI deck. And so it would have things, you know, like a percentage chance it wanted to recon, percentage chance it would build, heavy units, what type of tech thing it wanted. Did it want tech or bio? It depended on what cards that, you know, if it had a bunch of tech, researchers, it would go for that, you know, so you had to have different coefficients to, so the AI would know what kind of flavor deck it had and what odds it expected, you know, what were the odds it would draw an infantry unit or what were the odds it'd be a draw a research, a lab. And so I ended up building, hundreds of decks. For different difficulty levels. It was tedious and, that was one of those points where I thought, God, am I ever going to finish this? So.
Now, one area about Armageddon Empires, and this is something that we see in all your titles, is that they deal with very different, I guess, systems, like different rules and mechanics. Like in a typical strategy game, like Civilization, when two units meet, calculations are done on the side, and you get a result. In Armageddon Empires, when two sides meet, it just transitions to a completely different game system and different rules. How did you come about, I guess, trying to define and create these different interconnected systems?
Well, it's a huge board game. Well, I guess two influences. Number one is I always liked, in Master of Orion, your fleets met and then you did that tactical battle. So that was, the real thing I had looking there. I'm trying to think of other games I played like that. I know there are, but that's the one that really stands out. And then had a really strong board game influence, with rolling die, attack versus defense, trying to, get rid of hit points and the card system you had there where you were lining cards up on each side and, the front line can hit the other front line. If you have a ranged unit, you can shoot over your front line. So it's very board gamey. I think Battle Lore was out. I don't know if Battle Lore came out later, but games like that, tactical card games, Memoir 44, things like that, where I'd been playing. They were, board games were a big influence on how I put that together.
Now with the actual card systems. Obviously, since you have all these different interconnected systems, when you're coming up with, like, these games, like, pre-production and just, like, regular design, do you come up with, like, the lore and, like, general world first, or do you start thinking about, like, the mechanics and systems you want and then build the game around the set systems?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's in reality, it's a mixture of both, but I definitely pick the theme first, for every game I've done, and then have try to create mechanics that were interesting and also fit the theme to as great an extent as possible. It's probably the other, you get a Reiner Kinesia, I think that's how you pronounce that. He's got the mathematics laid out first, and then sometimes they do it great or they don't do it so great, they put a theme on it. But I'm the exact opposite, so.
Now, with Armageddon Empires and Solium Infernal, you release expansions, like a few things, like a year after, I think that was a year after Armageddon Empires was the first expansion.
Yeah, it was about every six months, at about a year point I'd done two, and that was the last one. And then Solium Infernum was a little bit different. I ended up making a Six Gun Saga first and then doing an expansion. So it was about a year, no, actually about 2 years.
Now, what's like your general thought process for developing expansions? Because with your games, they are really connected in terms of rules, so it can't be easy to try to create new rules and systems to add to the mix.
Yeah, that's a question. I try to take some of the things that I'd wanted to do but had cut or didn't have time or money or whatever. And then there's other things there's a lot of people with, who pick the systems apart, find strong points, weak points, things that aren't countered. I try to you know, take a lot of feedback from that I get on the games. You know, in Armageddon Empires, one of the last expansions I did called Tip of the Spear was really trying to address something that had been pointed out that, you know, infantry, the smaller units, with the combat system that I created didn't always, you know, finding their purpose was difficult. You could, there were roles for them and scouting and things like that, but going toe to toe, and having a decent chance of winning against, you know, a 100-foot, you know, mecha was difficult. So I came up with, you know, ways for them to work together, or special abilities that could be used to counter some of those. And then, so that's usually how those come together. Same thing with Solium Infernum. I tried to look at, you know, what some of the strategies were the players were using and come up with new relics and artifacts that would be interesting counters or interesting sort of monkey wrenches in the wheel.
This is a general question for all your titles. Normally, when you look at, like, beta testing, this is also great since Occult is currently going through buy and beta. But in a traditional beta, when you're trying to examine, you know, what works and what doesn't work, it's pretty simple to, like, see, you know, what's wrong with the UI, or is this unit too strong, or stuff like that. But with your games that are built heavily around these abstracted systems and rules, how do you, like, go about figuring out, you know, is this rule fun, or is this system actually working? Stuff like that.
Yeah, well, there's two ways. Like, for Occult Chronicles, I can't really say I built a board game prototype. I built a prototype with, I actually bought a deck of tarot cards and started playing around with it, trying to figure out what type of game I could create that would be interesting as the, you know, the challenge game. And so I came up with that game, and then I started thinking of, well, what are the ways I can, you know, change the outcome of the cards that have been revealed and when the tricks are being placed? And I mapped that out to some extent with the spells and the items. I mean, that's the funnest part, is creating all those, you know, little knickknacks and doodads that do things. And then, I got to the point where I had a rough framework that I could go and I could move around the house and do different things, and see how the flow was. It was very tough. You know, as one person designing and playing it, I knew I was going to have some issues. And that's part of what the beta buy-in is for, is to get, you know, feedback on, you know, what types of, you know, character development is working, what's overpowered, what's underpowered, you know, what items are getting used and what aren't. I've been really surprised. I know I saw a save game that you sent me, where you built basically a psychic character who had very low cups and swords. And I remember sitting there scratching my head, and my first thought, I was going to email you and say, I think you might want to rethink this. And then I looked at all the psychic cards you had, and I started playing some with it. And I was thinking, you know what? You can beat a lot of these challenges just with the psychic cards. And I had not really gamed that out very far, you know, as far as that being that effective.
Yeah, I was surprised too by that, because up until that point, I've been trying to work around using more sword and cup attribute abilities, but I just really like trying to create like the psychic or mind influence character, and that was the first time that all the psychic cards and edges started to fall in place. At one point, I mean, I was doing the combat challenge, I didn't even need to turn over any cards on the field, I just used all my psychic powers just to destroy all the cards and kill them. And then right before I sent you that save, I ran to one of the creatures in sub-level 1 who you couldn't use psychic powers on. I'm like, oh, crap. And it took like 20 sanity out of my gun. Like, oh, God, get out of here. But I was on cuffs.
Was that an abomination?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And then I ran into all the traps.
Yeah, I remember when I was building those abominations and thinking about the options to place on them. I think it's three of them have, you know, psychic, sorcery, and combat, and then two of them, the off ones, have just combat, I think, or maybe combat and sorcery. But I remember thinking I wanted to, you know, have some that you might encounter that you would go, oh, how am I going to do this one? So.
Yeah, and I had to get that one not only once, but then when I went to run away, a second one spawned behind me, so I was sandwiched between the two.
Now that's pure bad luck.
Which is pretty much the story of my life, I think.
You know, there is a timer. It's supposed to, but the psychic pushback might have affected that, because, the psychic, you know, the psychic cards that you use don't have any consumables. Like, you can run out of ammo and other things. and the pushback's supposed to have bad repercussions. So, you know, what it does is makes your wounds worse, or your psychic, your sanity loss worse. And it also does things like the cooldown on your random monsters is adjusted too, slightly. Not drastically, but.
And then right before I send you that save, I escape and I got the event that you fell into a hole. Like, okay, I'll fall in a hole because I have that 7-story token, so I want to get down there. But I'll fall in, that's okay. Oh, you fell into a spike pit. Damn it. Like, okay, wait, let me get out. All right, I survived. Let me open up the door. Oh, you trigger a gas trap. Damn it again. So are you going to adjust the slaggy edge? Did I find some sort of super secret, game-winning trick that you're going to change now?
No. I was thinking about, I'm going to take a look at it. I was thinking about maybe the pushback should be a little harder, but it sounds like it might have kicked in the right spot.
Yeah, right at that, once I got into that part, like, I was all good for the first floor, was just easy. Second floor, I got a little bit into it, but that's when I started to notice that my story was starting to run out, so I just made beeline straight for that basement. Then once I hit that basement, that's when all hell broke loose.
Yeah, the basement is interesting. It's modeled, that whole idea of, you know, you've done the upper floors of the house, you're buffed up, you're looking to go finish the final encounter off. The basement's modeled on the idea of Tomb of Horrors from Dungeons and Dragons, that famous S1 module, where you basically, it's Death Trap.
Nice.
that's not to say, I mean, everything's a death trap in there, but I made some really fun traps in there where, you know, things happen that if you don't solve, so usually it's a timer, you get several tries, but if you don't get it by the third or fourth try, you're a goner.
Yeah. I think I had that happen. I didn't have that happen on the first floor with like the green ooze that just envelops you.
Yeah, that's one of those, yeah.
And I think, one of the guys on quarter three who's doing an AR, he ran to another one with the gelatinous cube.
Yeah, the green cube. I renamed that for trademark copyright purposes.
Now, one other area that I do like, not only about Occult Chronicles, but with Solium Infernum and Armageddon Empire, is that there's a really good lore around the world. Like, you look at, like, the cards, they have good detail. With Solium Infernum, I just love, like, a lot of the flavor text that was on for like, the various items and for the various demon lords. Did you do a lot of the writing yourself, or did someone else do, like, the basic lore writing for your games?
Yeah, for Solium Infernum, which had all that flavor text, Russell Marsh actually did that, who's a gentleman I actually met. I think he was posted on QT3, and he did a great job for me he created a little sort of a mini world for all the text with that. For Occult Chronicles, I actually did the writing on the text for all the story encounters. And that was just because the system that I created, I started making notes to get a writer to do it. And I realized I was writing as much as I wanted, you know, in the game. And so I went with that. So
far from what I've seen, there's a lot of good notes in the Occult Chronicles, a lot of throwbacks to other horror titles.
Yeah. And that was part of the fun, of the game was, you know, making, you know, references, homages, wherever I could, having a little fun with that. There's some interesting, you know, there's probably got to be 20 or 30, real fun ones that you can run across.
All right. Before we talk more about Occult Chronicles, I want to go back for a few minutes to Solium Infernum, so we didn't get too far into that one.
Sure.
Now, with Solium Infernum, was Six Gun Saga a multiplayer game as well, or was that single player?
No, that was just single player, and the reason was it was meant to be, it was a failed game. I originally meant to make it, I was going to make a roguelike, and I was going to make a Western roguelike, and it just did not work. So I thought, well, I've got all this art, I'm going to make a coffee break game that's a little strategy game with my Western art, and that's how Six Gun Saga came out. So it's meant, it's, I think that's, you know, part of the reason I don't think it really caught on a lot with my client base and the customers who really, you know come to know my games is that I think it's not deep enough to really, you know, catch them like the first two games did.
With that last thing you said about your current clientele, one question I had regarding, like, do you see your strategy games more like, because obviously there's a lot of strategy games. We got general turn-based strategy games like Civilization, then we got, you know, the war games, stuff like Strategy First, Paradox of Crusader Kings. Where do you see, like, your strategy games, like, fit in that model? You know, more, like, more for, like, the extreme, the hardcore, or more like casual general, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, somewhere in between. I see them as board games that are brought to the computer. And they're not war games. You know, I am never going to be able to make a World War II game because I don't know the armor thickness on a Panther, you know, battle tank. That's going to be something that's just too daunting for me. That's just not where it's going to go. But if I can abstract it and come up with my own fun mechanics, you know, there's a lot of board game designers that I really admire. You know, there's, you know, Richard Borg. There's, who else? Martin Wallace has got a bunch of cool stuff now. Who else I like? Eric Lang, who's done, lots of stuff for Fantasy Flight. I love the thing that inspired me was the thought process they put in to creating the mechanics and the way they fit together and, the way they work off each other, the symbiosis you get between elements. So that's the intellectual stimulation I get from doing all this.
I'm really not traditionally a big board game fan. I grew up when there weren't a lot of games around, so I never really had a chance to play like board games like Ticket to Ride or, you know, the big ones. I think like Settlers of Catan. I think I've only tried that once in my entire life.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Euro fan myself. I'm more Ameritrash, you know, lots of pieces and roll and die. But Ticket to Ride, though, you should try. That's a fun family game. You can just sit down really quickly, you know, and make enemies. So.
Now, going back to, like, different mechanics and seeing how everything combines and the symbiosis behind that, I found that I really like Japanese RPGs, not like the big ones like Final Fantasy, but a lot like the smaller or AA titles that are less about, you know, these grand overarching stories and more about basically challenging the player to figure out this, you know, crazy rule set or create their own strategy using the mechanics provided. And that's another thing that I do like about your types of games, about that kind of board game design, where you're not dealing with, you know, these giant, grand-reaching, basically generalized aspects, but, you know, deep down in mechanics and trying to, you know, sort everything out.
Yeah, and discover the whole system, uncover it, and figure out which pieces. Yeah, I think, are you thinking about maybe Fire Emblem and games like that?
Yeah, Fire Emblem, Atlas, they do, like, the series called Shin Megami Tensei. They do some pretty crazy stuff with RPGs. It's sort of like, I guess the simplest way would be maybe like a take on like the Pokemon concept, where you have a party made up of like summonable creatures or, you know, creatures you find in the field. And they do a lot of stuff with like, if you hit an enemy in their weakness, you may get an extra turn. If they hit you with one of yours, they get an extra turn.
Yeah.
And they've been like playing around with this concept of having like bosses that can just like screw those rules up, like a boss who can like attack like three times in one turn compared to your two. And while it's not as complex as we see in, like, board games or turn-based strategy games, they do have, like, their own little, like, microcosm of rules and systems, I think, for the player. And it's something that I don't see, like, when I play, like, a big game like Final Fantasy or just, like general computer RPGs. Like, I didn't really get into Skyrim that much. And I know that's, like, one of, like, the big-name games that came out in the last few years.
Yeah, I didn't play a lot of Skyrim myself, but my son loved it. I have a 15-year-old son. I think he was played there. Explored every inch of it. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I actually would cop to playing a lot of Pokemon. But, and Fire Emblem too. I mean, it was similar too with, you know, but I haven't played, I've seen it. The title you're referring to, Shin Megami Tensei, is that it?
Yeah, it's like this whole, like, universe made by that one brand. They have like different side stories and whatnot. But yeah, pretty much any, you know, like the Shin Megami, any game that has that whole really long title usually has like some kind of crazy rules that's involved with it.
Yeah, I might try to take that up and give that a shot. It sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, they've been on the PlayStation 2 and they've done a lot with like the Game Boy, Nintendo DS and 3DS even work. But the most of the games have been on the PlayStation 2. They've been having trouble, I guess, keeping stock. They've gotten better with keeping copies out there.
It won't fit up to the PlayStation 3. You can't run it.
They may have re-released it for PlayStation 3. I know the latest one, it's called Persona 4. It's on the PlayStation 4. I think it's the new one, PSP Vita, which I don't have. I have just like the bare bones basic one. But they do have them on the Nintendo DS, and there's one coming for the 3DS and some.
Okay.
Let's move from Japanese crazy back to, I guess, Halloween.
I love it. I love anime, by the way. So
we could probably have a whole conversation on that after this.
I'm not going to go to cosplay, but I do.
Oh my god. with Solarium Infernum as a multiplayer game, how did you approach design differently compared to Armageddon and Occult, which are just single player titles?
Yeah, well, with the multiplayer, I was looking to games like Diplomacy, and games where you would have, you know, some game theory interactions among players, and so I definitely came up with the rule set there that it would be humans playing each other, and the Diplomacy was something I really wanted to, the player-to-player, packs and interactions I wanted to codify. That was my little, you know, light bulb that went above my head, was to try to take those types of relationships and implement them into, the mechanics so that they're actually concrete. So when you have a pact or an alliance that there's the rules change for the two of you behaving with each other. There's still ways you can backstab each other, and there's a system in there that's deceit, which lets you still target your allies, your friends. But for the most part, you then had expectations on how you were going to behave until you broke that relationship. And even the warfare between the players is all codified, in that you just can't willy-nilly start attacking somebody. You have to go through this ritual of, you know, making threats and demands and insulting, and then get to the point where you're allowed to actually try to take some territory.
And that's sort of similar to what they do, I think, in Crusader Kings or Europa Universal with the Cassius Bell, I think is what it's called.
I have never played Crusader Kings. I've read a lot about it and people loving it. But that's interesting. I know I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I barely played either. I tried it like once or twice and I just found myself just completely, you know, over my head. I even tried watching like tutorials. Like there's like people do like 4 or 5 hour tutorial videos on YouTube. Like, no, I'm backing away slowly from this one.
I always liked the thing that they did though. I think this is the game where you had this bloodline that you had to keep continuing, and it was sort of like, you know, with Rome Total War, where you had these personas that they could have offspring, and you had an heir, and you know, they could get crippled or gimped. I think that happens in Crusader Kings.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Like, yeah. They have, like, all these, like, different, like, personality traits that can happen, and then it just gets crazy from there. I saw, like, someone made, like, a Game of Thrones mod for it, which I just started watching the show this year, so now I'm thinking about, like, that sounds pretty cool now.
Hey, how'd you like that Red Wedding?
Oh, that was lovely. Alright, so we've got anime, war games, hell, and Game of Thrones all in one cast. I think good.
Shane, ding.
Now, with Solarium Infernum, one of the things I really liked about was like the whole auction system. You can like bid on the various items and the champions. Because that also plays in what you're talking about, like, trying to get players to, you know, cooperate but not really cooperate with each other.
Yeah, that auctioning, market mechanic there, I got from the idea from different game, board games, where you'd have an auction for whatever resource or asset it is you want. It's a cool way. I was really pleased with myself because, I use it to, it's how the game injects, the units, the legions into the game. So the value of those legions isn't set by the designer, it's set by what the players are willing to pay, and how bad they need it, or what it might offer their strategy. So I thought that was really, it worked really well and was really cool.
Now, Solarium Infernum also had an expansion. I don't think I picked that one up. What did that add?
Yeah, that's another free expansion. It was called Rectification. That's sort of a double entendre on trying to change some of the rules that I thought needed, you know, to be fixed a little bit. And also, I always loved that, that thing from Ghostbusters where the guy says the rectification of Valdrani. So That's, you'll actually find, I think, a couple little allusions to that in the game text. But, so yeah, so basically, and I gotta get my head wrapped around this, what I did. I created a bunch of new artifacts and relics that added new powers to the game. I created a new, diplomatic action called, oh lord, what was it called? Basically, you made a claim that you could take a piece of, a territory, and they had to hold it, and if they didn't, you won. You could only attack one hex. I can't remember. Demand of, oh boy, this is bad. but it's there. but basically what it was, you know, let's say you saw a hex next to you, you had a border, you bordered with one of your opponents, and there was a hex you wanted. You could basically, assertion of weakness, that's what it was called. So you would say, I can take this hex, and you give them that notification, and they'd have to respond through the conclave of, you know, Pandemonium, which is the infernal, you know, sort of quasi-governmental UN for hell. And, they had to respond and say, you know, yes, you can have it, or no, I can keep it from you. And then you were allowed to fight over just that one hex. So it was a sort of a cool little way of controlling, you know, the warfare a little more and making, which territory you wanted to seize more specific. Usually in a normal military action, you claim vendetta, and then you'd have to go about this process of claiming, territory, you know, with your military units, but it could get really messy. So this was much more contained and limited. And I had a bunch of, like I said, I had a bunch of new powers through the relics and artifacts. And I'm going blank after that.
All right, and one other question, I guess, before we move on to Occult Chronicles. Another area that I like about your games is you have a very, I guess, your art style, you have very consistent art style in your games. Like, everything looks, nothing looks out of place. Do you use the same artist for all your titles, or do you have different artists for each game?
I've had different artists. A gentleman named Matt Bradbury in England, did a lot of the, actually almost most of the work for, all the work for Solium Infernum. I want to make sure I don't insult anybody, for the illustrations. Ben Soans did, the beautiful, map work and, icons, for Solium Infernum. For Matt Bradbury did, a lot of the stuff for Armageddon Empires, two of the factions, and then I had some, other artists who did, the factions for, Armageddon Empires. Each usually would do, one. Zdenek Zasek did, Empire Man. And I'm having problems with, one of the other artists. Sorry. Didn't mean to insult anybody here. I actually, hooked up with a new artist for Occult Chronicles. And his name is David North. And I ran across him actually, one of my, friends in town here recommended him. He just graduated from art school and, was looking to make a portfolio. And, he started doing some work for me, and it was so excellent that we just ran with it. He's actually, David North Illustration is his website, and he does, lots of art and does his own, mobile games too. And I know he's been doing pretty well with those. So, my sister Katie Davis does, the interface art for every game I've made. So all the, you know, the phony, notepads, the buttons, you know, all that stuff she's made. And, so thanks, Katie.
So let's move on and let's talk about Occult Chronicles now. Now we mentioned a few minutes ago about how the sub areas were inspired by Dungeons & Dragons. Where did the actual overall concept of Occult Chronicles come from?
I came from, wanting to do a roguelike and, then playing basically the big one was Betrayal House on Haunted Hill, which is a haunted house board game. Have you ever seen that? Played that?
No, but I heard you mentioning it in the...
Yeah. It's one of my all-time favorite games. Basically, you got a bunch of square tiles and you pick an investigator. Sound familiar? And, you, start out in the foyer and you start flipping tiles over as you want to move from room to room. And, it has this really cool, it's a dice system for resolving everything, but you get cards that are your items and cards flip over that things happen, you know, you encounter different things. But then at a certain point, an omen card will be drawn and you'll roll dice and the haunting occurs. And there's a special rule book that you get, one player determined by the die roll basically becomes the traitor. And the rest of the players are the players who have to resist whatever the traitor's mad, you know, story is. And there must be 60, 70 unique stories for each one. And that's how the game plays out. So that's a lot of the inspiration for what I did. And I morphed various elements in different ways. You know, it's not a direct, porting of that or anything, but there's a huge inspiration. And the other game is, Mansions of Madness, which came out while I actually had been designing the game. I'd already designed the core parts of it. But I really liked a lot of things they did in Mansion of Madness, the Fantasy Flight game, which is, you know, it's their Lovecraft, Cthulhu, haunted house game. Yeah. So.
Now, with Occult Chronicles, since it is being developed from a roguelike standpoint, how are you approaching it differently from, like, your strategy designs, like with Armageddon and Solium?
Yeah, that was the thing I had to find out, I had to figure out what were the strategy, the decision points going to be in the game, and how would players, what would they be able to do, to influence the gameplay. And so there were a couple levels. So the first level that was obvious was the map, was figuring out which areas you wanted to go to, which ones were dangerous. Did you want to go in that room if it looked like you could get trapped in there? There's that symbol there that says there might be something there. So that was exploring the map is a huge part of the game. And it's also part of how I want players to have different decision points. And then the big thing was when you encounter something and you play this tarot card game to determine if you win is, you know, the tarot cards are dealt out and they're fixed at that point. So they're either going to be pretty good or pretty bad or maybe medium. And at that point, you can use different, items and abilities that you have to try to change the outcome, of the card game so that you can win instead of lose. And there's a lot of thinking that has to go. I mean, I overdid it on some of the abilities are probably a little too complex and wordy. I'm going to go back and try to see if I can reword them a little better. Although, you know, the concepts are pretty tough. There are things like, you know, flip a card over, look at the number, if it's a face card or a number card and do a certain thing. And you have to roll a dice in between. So it's tough explaining those mechanics, but I find, you know, my puny mind, I do have to sit down and focus, okay, what exactly does this mean? And I wrote it. So that's not great, but it is meant to be a meaty game that you have to think about and engage in with, you know, intellectually. So.
Yeah, like with the psychic edges, as you were looking at what I was doing with them, I was mainly using, I think, the Dispel Spirit and I think Dominate. Because I was like trying to figure out what some of those other cards were doing, and it does get a little tricky. And I think with the bug that I showed you with how it was recognizing that I won the hand, but still dealt punishment cards, it can be a little tricky once you start mixing all these different rules and trying to figure out what's the actual solution.
Yeah, I actually, and thanks to you and several other people who sent that in, I found that and I have fixed that. And that was there's a little algorithm that says calculate the trick points that you've taken so far. And so it was doing that and showing you as having won, but then when you press the win button, some data was getting cleared before it could calculate the number again to send you whether to the lose or the win subroutine. And so you were going to the lose subroutine even though it was saying it was winning. So, but that's fixed. So that's yeah. I'm sure that was frustrating. I apologize.
And that, of course, didn't happen until that final sub area. So that's, of course, when it's really bad with the abominations. Now, with the design, I guess with the different systems, how did you decide, you know, what the heroic feats were going to be versus, you know, psychic and magic feats?
Yeah, I try to come up with a theme for each one. So, you know, ranged abilities, if you notice, there's no die roll involved to see if they win, and there's a fixed number. Melee, it's variable numbers, but there's a die roll to see whether you hit. And then if you go to spells usually have some very dramatic effect, and you can draw some cards. And psychic abilities, they're meant to focus on just gaining points directly, with some, you know, added bonuses here and there, you know, doing different things. The heroic feats, you know, I'm trying to think about those. Those basically, They let you bump cards, and they let you get, you get a draw, usually an extra card on each one. And they cover a lot of areas that, are sort of utility areas. Intellect, there's like four intellect feats. There's, oh, the defensive ones will basically, you know, help you out, in cup ones, some of them for evade traps, you know. So, but there, I did sit down and try to come up with general thematic guidelines for each one, what they were going to do.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. But like I said, with the, I did experiment a little with magic. Saw that with the save I sent you. I did, it was heavily psych, but then I started branching into magic. And I found magic was definitely, you know, a huge difference from the psychic spells, because that's when I started noticing, hey, I'm taking damage while I'm using these spells.
Yeah, that's the whole idea with the magic was that you, each spell has a special die that's associated with it. And, it's sort of cool. You can, when you cast that spell, you roll that die. And if you roll, if you roll equal to or below your attribute, you're okay. But if you roll above it, then you take the difference in a wound. So there's a little bit of risk involved. Now, if you keep bumping up your attribute in pentacles, eventually you'll get to the point where you don't have to worry about it, except for the fact that every die has at least one mandatory wound face. So you'll roll that one wound, and it doesn't even matter what your attribute is, you're going to take a wound.
I think that's what's happening to me if yeah. I'm those damn dice rolls. Going back, we were talking about with the design of a roguelike. What would be considered, like, difficult? Like, what would be too hard to the player versus, you know, the right kind of challenge?
Yeah, that's a huge, element in it. I don't even know that I've gotten that right, so far. And I'm gonna look at the balance on a lot of this. But my experience is, I don't want people to have to save scum. You know, I don't want people to have to game the system, to succeed. I wanted, you know, a very linear build in difficulty, but I wanted, you know, also to be able to have something completely unexpected happen where it was either really bad luck or really good luck. And that's what some of those cards, like the instant death and instant insanity cards are. Now, there aren't very many in the game, and they're in very specific encounters. Usually it's a handful of the traps, and I don't want to give away spoilers away on some of the encounters you might have, but you can pretty much figure out, you know, if something's going to be really dangerous. I did get, you know, one complaint. I guess this is sort of a spoiler, but that they had looked into the crystal ball and the result had been gone against them, and they were very unhappy that, you know, that this had happened. And I felt bad for the player, but I was thinking myself. I was thinking, you know, you walk up into a room, you look into a crystal ball, and you go insane. it can't be completely unexpected. But,
yeah, I'm not going to spoil the one that killed me, but I think it's one that two or three people on the Court of Three forums also that we were all like, you know, like when we first saw it, I was like, eh, this can't be that bad. And then you get
I think
like,
I know what you're talking
how
about.
How did I like, die? Like, oh, that's, now it sort of makes sense. Now, with Occult Chronicles, now I saw there's different stories. There's like the one with the cult, there's aliens, vampires. Do the stories themselves lend to a difficulty, or are they just merely there for plot and lore?
Yeah, they don't have any direct effect on difficulty, but they have an effect on the roaming, the random encounters you'll get during the game. Each one has a separate group of encounters. And also the final encounter, there's usually between two and three tiles, special tiles for each mission. So, you know, like for, I don't want to give it away, but each one has a special sort of, the artist did a hand rendering of a special area that you'll encounter. And then the final encounter there is unique as well. Whoever the head, you know, the boss is.
Yeah, I haven't done any of the final challenges yet, so I can't really spoil anything for the people listening.
Well, the other interesting aspect there I'll tell you about too is you'll notice when some of the clues that you'll get in the basement, are unique as well for each encounter. And they are unique in that they will, if you have them at the final encounter, they'll give you special options you can do. And they each have a nice little, they're not just, you know, most of the clues are generic with a little, you know, magnifying glass. These ones have special little, symbols on them.
Yeah, I saw two of them while I was doing the story involving the ex-odd agent or the guy.
Yeah.
I found two of them. I hadn't really searched the basements yet because that's as tall about when things get really difficult. So I'm just trying to run through them while health and sanity are, you know, draining fast.
when you make it to the final area for that one, you'll figure out what those symbols mean. So look back at those when you get there. They'll be very helpful.
Now, with Occult Chronicles, as you talked about earlier regarding like expansions and stuff that you've left out, are there any mechanics that are right now left on the drawing boards that may be added into the future of the Occult Chronicles, or is everything there, you know, what you came up with originally?
No, there's a bunch, actually. I ended up taking out a lot of things just because I couldn't get it to work at the time, or it was just looking a little too daunting to get to work correctly. And a lot of things I'd like to add, one of them is what I'm probably going to add, before the beta is over, is making the talismans more effective. And I'm going to put those on the cards that the player draws. And you'll have the choice of whether or not to activate the talisman and risk losing it, but also then getting a nice effect for your draw cards, which should give some interactivity to the early game. So everybody gets a starting talisman at least, and you can start making decisions on that. Another system is a thing counteractions. And these were tokens that were going to go on the tarot cards on the board. And if you flip that tarot card over, whatever that token was would trigger. And it would make the game more difficult. Anything from, removing that card to bumping it up to having you directly lose points. And there was going to be a whole sub game with trying to counter those and manipulate those, move them off the board, move them to cards that had already been triggered. So that's something I could explore. The way I gamed it out, it would definitely up the difficulty level. I don't know if that's what the game needs right now.
Yeah, it's hard to say really, just from my point, because that last game, that's both the furthest I've gone. That was the first time that I really started to mess around with the various spell and modifiers for altering card game. But I think I've read that other people may have been it, but I don't know what typically level they played on, or if they played on normal mode or permadeath.
Yeah, exactly. The normal mode, you're going to start over, so it's, and if you play without the clock too, there is an option to play without the story clock. You can basically just freeform it. So yeah, I've seen a wide range of, save games, of how people do now. I've seen people who've been just, doing very well, and I think, like you said, this happened to you, and then all of a sudden something just doesn't click and a couple of bad rolls and then you're really sucking wind. So it's a difficult system to balance. I want people to be able, it's not going to be like, what's the game that's so tough? Brogue, I think it is. There's another one too. It's not NetHack, but Angband. There are games where people play their entire life and maybe finish one. I don't want it to be like that. I want people to be able to finish and enjoy it and, get the character in the Archives Hall of Fame. So, it's tough.
Now, speaking about the card game, before I forget, I think you mentioned this on the Core 3 forum, but where did the basis for the card matching minigame come from?
It came from my sitting down and thinking, okay, I've got this challenge here. I most games would resolve this with like a die roll. You'd have an attribute, like there's games like Arkham Horror, where you have an attribute and then you roll two die and if you roll, below it, you're fine. If not, you fail. And there's games that do that with fudge dice with different, type systems. I wanted something, the tarot idea seemed, very intriguing. I don't know a lot about the occult. I read up on the history of, occultism and 18th century D and all that type of stuff. But I wanted to do something that was fun that would fit into the game. So I came up with, the different occult suits being matched to different physical or different things you would encounter in the game. And then from there, I came up with, oh, hey, let's do a trick-taking game. Because tarot cards originally were done as a trick-taking game. And, the major arcana were trumps. And there's I actually researched, there was, some of the Italian decks that were made, to play the game and, the rules. And, I thought, well, let's just try to simplify it. Let's come up with, a way to gather crew points and try to beat a number. And that number would then determine how hard, how many points you had to get, how hard was the encounter. So that's sort of the genesis of that.
And the abstraction there is definitely interesting, because as we talked about, different encounters have different, basically, solutions, which will play around with the different attributes. Like, you have, with like the crystal ball, I think one was you could try using it, another was using magic, and then there's just, you know, running the hell out of the room.
Yeah, and that was the fun thing, you know, figuring out what the different response, I called them options you could have for each encounter, and trying to get enough of a varied mix that you couldn't, you know, you had to have some ability for a different option to work, but then you might have a trade-off. Oh, this one's going to give me more cards to draw, and I think I should be drawing more cards on this one. So, you know.
Regarding, like, the reward portion, you're drawing, you're flipping over cards for your various rewards, is there a difference in, I guess, chance of getting more upgrade tokens versus using a combat option or, like, a psychic or magic option, or is it just, like, the same kind of variability?
No, they're each encounter has a special list of rewards it can draw from. And then on top of that, the game has some meta, categories that it will add or subtract. So that lets you, let me flavor the different, options and what their rewards and penalties would be. Cause you'll find, like, you know, with traps, there's a lot of times you'll take a wound card, which will really gimp your swords or cups. So yeah, that's definitely hand crafted, but with the caveat that there's, you know, some meta categories on top of that, to balance it. I found it was tough deciding what ones should give you a ward. I wanted wards to be, I mean, not ward there. I, that's the internal code name is talisman. How often should players be getting those? So things, balancing things like that was tough.
Yeah, that's what I was noticing with the save that I sent you. At that point, once I developed those psychic powers to that level of being, I got the edge that lets you use multiple cards in a single challenge.
Yeah, I saw that. You had like four. You could use it like four times.
Yeah, that was just fun. I mean, at that point, I was like, yeah, I think I may have broke the game. But yeah, it was just like, oh no, I only can draw two cards. Who cares? Dominate, get like 20 points.
Now, I remember thinking that those would be useful cards, but I remember thinking, okay, now those are going to be useful in combat and psychic situations. So, you know, other things could pop up, hopefully, that would challenge, you know, with the player. So it's, you know, you are powerful, but there are some, you have an Achilles heel too. And the pushback is supposed to hurt, but I think maybe it needs to hurt some more, so I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't know so. I was trying to read up what the actual say pushback was doing, but I think does it only affect you if you lose a counter, or does it affect like win potential as well?
No matter what, even the win potential, yeah.
So
it's use at your own peril. It generates that pushback when you use it, no matter if you win or lose.
Okay. And I also saw there's luck and misfortune aspects that you can draw, and what do they affect? Like you take the Aria of Fortune or Aria.
Yeah, it's another input on with the difficulty level on a lot of things that will happen randomly. And it's, you know, it's hidden, and that's a long story in itself, and that, you know, I'd added this in the middle of the game in the design, cause I really wanted a little more variability in some of the random roles that were happening, and the idea that you would do things, maybe foolish things, like a lot of times you can get luck things if you do, I mean, get misfortune, if you're doing something that's a little foolish. So the idea was that those things would accrue negative, effects. And so when a random number is taken, a lot of things like, you know, should another random encounter be generated, or, you know, should you, what's the level of health card you're going to get as a reward or a penalty? Those all affect that.
Because that was one of the things I was noticing. I wasn't quite sure how they were affecting things. I thought that the omen, the sport one, that was affecting the chance I was seeing more death cards, but as you were saying that certain counters are just geared towards that meta chance that they would draw a death or insane card.
Yeah, well, the instant death, there are encounters where it's a random probability, it's not guaranteed. So the instant death one, some of them they're actually, you fail, it's visible, you die. Others, they're created and they're hidden in the 10 cards you have to choose from. Now, their luck will determine what the chance of that card being in those 10 cards is. So if your luck's really bad, you're going to have a good chance that instant death card's going to be there.
Now, I'm going back to what you were saying in terms of deciding how much reward the player. That was one of the aspects I saw in my game. I think at that point in the game, I think I completely or just about filled up all three of my background cards. But then again, I was going more for the combat side of things, and it seemed like combat had a greater chance of giving upgrade tokens.
Yeah, that might be something to take a look at. There, I know there was a lot, the combat ones were, a lot of the times they're against things that are like, mechanical. And so my reasoning was, you know, you're taking a big risk. It's got a high target level to win. You know, I'll increase the chance of the tokens, the expertise tokens being generated. But yeah, that might be something to look at. I wanted it so that you would end up, you know, being about 3-4 story tokens away from the end and then deciding, oh, I got to get there. And, you know, you've buffed your guy up with your skill cards. So it might need some tweaking still.
There's definitely a lot of factors in the game. Like, as you said, that you can make your character really powerful, but you can't make them all powerful. There's always going to be that one type of encounter, that one trap that your character will be completely, you know, weak against.
Yeah, and that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah, like, as I said, with my character, if I couldn't use the psychic abilities, my guy was, you know, going to get his ass kicked really bad. Or, because I have high cuffs, when the trap started to come, you know, fast and heavy in the basement, I was getting hit with trap after trap, and I was just hoping that I wasn't going to draw a death card.
Yeah, the glass cannon, I think it's called, right?
Yeah. Now, with the actual backgrounds and a lot of, like, the character generations, you decide, you know, how strong the character should be or what was the available options at the start of the game.
Yeah, that was pretty much just, you know, off the cuff. I came up with a list of interesting professions and not professions, backgrounds that I wanted, and trying to balance, you know, there's basically, you know, I think there's about 3 for each major tarot suit. Some of them are meant to be more hybrids than others, or be able to built into hybrids. And so each one would have a major theme, and then you could, you know, you could branch off from there with your skill cards. You could pick the, you know, the cop and then make them, you know, a spellcaster, type thing, and be able to, you know, it's meant so that you can, you know, you've got 4 different die that you can possibly have, but you're only going to be guaranteed 3 die total, unless you get lucky with something else.
Yeah. Now, with the dies, are there, like, I know, say, the normal dies, like the die of 1, die of pentacle, like, I think it's rolls numbered 1-6. Are there, like, additional die, like, for those types hidden in the game, or the types that you find through the background or upgrades? Is that all there are in terms of dies?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually another feature that got deleted or removed. I actually have 4-sided die, 8-sided die, and 10-sided die of all those. And I originally had a system where you could upgrade your die and change the face numbers. That's why those are all so detailed there on, so you can see each face. And I'd like to go and explore that in expansion, you know, down the road maybe, and let players be able to change the die. It just, I already felt like I had such a kitchen sink thrown in that to add that kind of complexity was just going to overdo it. So I sort of backed off and, just went with the 6-sided die.
Definitely does sound interesting, just having more control, because I think that's one of the things that a lot of people, I guess, have some nitpicks, as you said, about the beginning of the game. But beginning to midpoint, there really aren't as many options or ways for you to affect the game as you do once you start, you know, fully exploring the various feats and spell cards you find.
Yeah, and I thought about maybe upping the starting equipment, but part of me really... I feel like that's going to take away from that thrill you get when you're really weak and you get something cool. So I don't know. It's a tough one.
It's definitely a give or take, because everything you do in the beginning will obviously resonate to the mid and end game. So if you make the beginning too easy, it's going to make it easier to get the upgrades, and then that's going to affect difficulty when you get to the basement. So it's really one of those cases where, you know, one slight deviation ripple out and affect all the other systems.
Yeah, just cascades. Yeah, exactly.
Start wrapping up. I just have a few just like general questions left for Full Chronicles.
Sure.
So as we mentioned, the game is in beta buy-in now. Do you have an idea for when you're actually going to release Full Chronicles?
Yeah, I think probably mid to late July. I don't want to rush it out. It's in pretty good shape right now. I don't think there's any, especially compared to my previous games, Armageddon Empires and Solium Inferno, those had some serious, you know, issues.
Folks, looks like I lost Vic. He got kicked out of Skype. So we're going to try to get it back at this point, but in case I can't get him back on for tonight, we're going to end the cast here. Hopefully, if I talk to Vic again, I'll thank him for being on. And if you are interested, of course, in coming onto the cast at a later point or writing a piece for the site, feel free to contact us. You can find it on our front page under Submissions Wanted. And well, we're going to end this, I guess, abrupt cast here. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Have a great weekend, and I will talk to you again next week.